This is what I think people have trouble grappling with. We are only 10 months into Trumpism.
I don't have any trouble grappling with it. I'm living it 1 second at a time. But I do. Some other people
are struggling. One take at a time.
Yes. Some people are struggling with that. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. This is JBL here with my best friends, Sarah Longwell and Tim Miller of The Bulwark. Guys, we are back together, separated by screens the way God intended. It was great seeing with you, being in meat space with you. Lovely. Thanks.
So nice.
Let's do that again.
Wish we would have gotten able to hang out afterwards, but you know, you had to get back home. You know, you had to put the kids to bed. You were just right around the corner from your house in New York.
Yep. And you were heading out to where?
I behaved. I went to Nobu with my a friend.
Nobu.
I got fancy. I got shishi.
It's very fancy. So we were together in DC and New York, and we're going to have a lot going on in DC, New York, and all of the rest of the country this Saturday at the giant No Kings protests. And we've got a little bit of a propaganda war going on about it, because on the one hand, you have the people who are preparing to go out in all of their best frog costumes and their little inflatable animal things. And
not then, Pepe the Frog, just to be clear. We're taking back the frog for the pro-liberal democracy.
This is a real know your meme moment.
Yeah.
Could we reclaim Pepe?
We're reclaiming the frog.
Okay. And at the same time, you have the Speaker of the House, the House Majority Whip, the Secretary of Transportation, going out and saying that these protests are Antifa, which is kind of a big deal because the president just signed an executive order saying that Antifa is a domestic terrorist organization. And so if true that these protests are going to be run by and featuring Antifa, which is a domestic terrorist organization, like if it was ISIS, if somebody said these protests are going to be done by ISIS or Al-Qaeda, then I would assume that law enforcement would be there to arrest every single person showing up to them.
Well, and some of them called said terrorists. I forget who it was. Was it Emmer or Duffy? They're all blending together. But Johnson, one of them literally used the word terrorist.
I believe that was Emmer. So, I mean, I guess we don't have to take this seriously in the sense of, like, they don't really mean that these things are Antifa, because if they did, then they would be doing something. But we should kind of take it seriously as a propaganda effort. No?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we should take it seriously insofar as it means that they're really nervous about these events. They think Americans are taking it seriously. I mean, you just said it's going to be a giant thing. We don't know that until everybody turns out. But I do suspect, based on sort of the pent up desire for people and just my own social circles, like the people I know, people who are training in, I'm getting texts about it. Lots of people are going. Obviously, we're hearing from our listeners. I'm going. And so I think that their rhetoric is a reflection of how nervous they are about seeing a really big pushback to Donald Trump. And they're trying to frame it in a certain way up front. Although I suspect, and one of the things I like about No Kings, you know, if you look at something like the LA protests around ICE or some of them, they're spontaneously driven by a kind of a raw, angry emotion. And that's fine, but that's where you end up setting Waymos on fire. Like the No Kings protests are structured. They have places where people are going to go. They're running ads. Everybody is emphasizing the peaceful nature of them. I suspect it will be dominated by, you know, people who are of all ages. But I think this movement really has been led, as best I can tell, by like the salt of the earth boomers who are out there with their great signs. You know, every time I drive up and down 16th Street in DC or Connecticut Avenue, it is a 65-year-old woman who has been standing there for hours. And I just want to say to you, if you are one of those people, God bless you. Way to go. I honk for you every single time and we'll be out there with you. But, you know, I do think it's funny. I think it will present a contrast. Sometimes we get notes from people, you know, people saying, you guys, you know, dismiss us, calling us boomers or talking about us being librarians. And I just want you to hear something. Yeah, I was talking about chapstick, the fanny packs. Hear me when I say this. Part of what we want to explain is the contrast between how they want to frame the people of the protests, right? Mike Johnson wants America to believe that it is terrorists, that it is Antifa, that it's a bunch of young thugs in masks out there trying to light cities on fire. And we want to make it clear, no, it is normie adults who want to take their country back, who especially people who are on the older side, because they've lived through long stretches, both, I think, A, because they knew the protests of the 60s, then lived through a long stretch of normal liberal democracy and the post-World War II order, which they appreciate. And so they're the ones, I think, with some of the clearest focus about what we stand to lose, which is why they're out there.
And the most free time. Yeah, I don't know. The thing is, thing about this is, I think that their messaging is backfiring for the reason Sarah laid out, but just also for Streisand effect reasons and other. I just don't think it works. Like Donald Trump, like, thinks he can play bully ball power politics because it's like mostly worked for him, right? Like, you know, saying the election was stolen, like, ended up working for him, right? Like, just calling everybody names, like, works for him. It doesn't work for everybody. Like, it doesn't always work, right? And we shouldn't just, like, submit to that or acknowledge it. Sometimes I think that gets me the most frustrated. I've been in a couple of disagreements recently, both on MSNBC and on various podcasts in my private life with people that are like, for some reason, I'm being the optimist right now about just election stuff in 2026. Yeah, watch out, Sarah. And these protests coming this weekend, et cetera. And it's because, like, I think that there's a backlash effect to this stuff, right? And I think that there are, you know, and I reject kind of the element of, you know, we're a dictatorship now. It's like, no, like, he's trying, but, like, now is the moment to fight it, right? And that's why I think the protests are important on Saturday. That's why I think that electoral politics, which we're going to talk about a little bit, is going to be important next November. And this November, I guess, with these governor's races. And I think that their strategy just isn't landing this time. And I think that what they're really doing is engaging more people than would have been engaged otherwise. And I think that there is a counter, you know, kind of world where they pretend like the No Kings protests aren't happening. And, like, where Trump does victory laps about the hostages or does whatever other stuff he does, bleats about, like, the cable news segment that he doesn't like, where there still would be people out there, like the types of people Sarah talking about, the committed people, right? But maybe it becomes a little bit more of a blip. And I kind of think the way they've handled this is going to backfire in this instance. Obviously, I think there are other ways in which their bullying power politics is working.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me because I am dispositionally not a protest guy. In the same way that I am not a
same
fellowship guy.
Same.
Or, you know, like, when I hear churches talk about fellowship, I'm like, where's the exit? I don't know. That's not why I come to church. I don't even really like shaking hands during sign of peace, Tim. That was always really? A little bit too much for me.
I do, because I kind of started spacing out before that. And it's nice for me to kind of touch another human and remind that I'm still here on earth. But
do not care for the sign of peace.
Sometimes the clammy hands are a little bit.
Too much human contact.
I always dreaded this part, having to hold hands, not shake hands, but when they would make you hold hands.
Yeah, the clammy hands, tough. Ugh.
But I feel like these protests are actually really important because the only way out of this is people power. And these are, like, shows of strength, I think, right? This is, I mean, the only way to really demonstrate it, aside from the voting and the elections. Are you guys worried about, I don't want to...
Violence.
Yes, but not just, I'm like, specifically Chicago. So if I were the administration and I was DHS and I wanted to make No Kings look bad, I would fixate on Chicago where tensions are already very, very high. And I would use law enforcement and do a law enforcement action somewhere as a pretext and just kind of hope that things got out of hand. Tim, you interviewed Governor Pritzker yesterday. It was a great, really great interview. Good conversation. And he talked about the importance of No Kings and how people are going out. He did not seem concerned at all.
Well, I think that it's important for him to project positivity. He wants people to be out and protesting. Sure. And so I don't think that means that they're not doing due diligence. I didn't ask him about this question, so I'm speculating. I want to get back to some of the Pritzker stuff in a second, but I think to your point about the security, I think there's reason to be concerned. And these things weren't connected, but we should remember that, like, the morning of the last No Kings protest, like, it was the night before that the Minnesota legislators had gotten assassinated, or the legislator and her husband. And so there was fear, right? Like, I think the Minnesota No Kings protest got canceled, if I'm remembering correctly, right? So, you know, I mean, we're at a fraught moment. And, like, so there could be certainly violence related. There could be certain violence unrelated that kind of gets, like, mashed up in all this, particularly in Chicago, where there is, like, you know, again, it's getting better, but there is violence in Chicago. So I think that that's a legit thing to be concerned about. And I think that the administration obviously is going to be looking for pretenses to crack down more. And they're targeting these protests as one of them. But, you know, like, the flip side to all of that is, how do I put this in a way that seems right? I mean, like, you can never stop one-off crazy people. We have a lot of one-off crazy people with easy accesses to weapons in this country. And that's basically a fundamental problem in the country. The broad groups, like, the MAGA groups are still kind of riding high, right? Like, their violence, a lot of their violence, like, came at a time when, right, like, Trump had lost, right? And, like, there was this feeling of a losing of power. And so, like, what I am not expecting is, like, a 2020 era, like, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys versus Street, you know, like, that. I think that the administration would want that, honestly. But I don't think we're going to see that on Saturday. And I think that obviously you have to be vigilant about one-offs, but I don't know what can be done about that, really.
Let's take what you're talking about seriously, though, for a second, because I do think that the conversation that they're having, where they're saying that it's terrorists and saying that it's Antifa, they want to go into these protests with a reason to crack down on people. Like, what you were saying earlier, we're like, well, wouldn't they arrest everybody if it was? It's like, no, but they might try to crack some skulls. They might try to stir up trouble. And the thing about No Kings, and even maybe the fact that it is being led by this older generation, has been that there has been, and I talked about this a lot at the live shows, people do not want to give them a reason. Nobody seems to have been tempted so far to bait, like, or to go for their bait. And I think that's been a really, really strong message. And I would love to see that hold throughout the No Kings protest this weekend. If it can be massive and peaceful, and to the extent that those guys are out there trying to stir some up, if you can show people that you won't go for it, that is an enormously powerful optic.
And just last question, we'll move on from this. But when you guys look at how you sustain a mass mobilization like this, I actually like the No Kings spacing these protests out by a good distance. I think it's good to let the appetite for them increase and not make them be special, you know, special events. But man, it's still a full year till the 2026 elections. I mean, this is what I think people have trouble grappling with. We are only 10 months into Trumpism.
I don't have any trouble grappling with it. I'm living it 1 second at a time. Fair enough. But I do. Some other people
are struggling. One take at a time.
Yes. Some people are struggling with that. Yeah.
What's interesting to me about the No Kings that's different, right? That one of the reasons that, like, the corporate media and all of these companies, they cave, is because they believe there's no energy left on the anti-Trump side, right? They believe the culture and the energy is with Trump. Him winning the popular vote was a huge psychological turning point for the country. And I think part of what the No Kings does is it gives you a container outside of an election to demonstrate how big the opposition is. It is easy to forget that Kamala Harris didn't lose, like, she lost every swing state, but it wasn't by massive margins, right? Like, the country is not firmly on Trump's side. And so I think that giving opportunities for people to remember that Donald Trump will not be permanently in charge, that there will be an opportunity for backlash, that there will be elections. I want to stomp on something Tim said because I think it's so important. I am hostile to the idea that we should act like Trump 2028 is a fait accompli. Like, we fight about this amongst each other, but I'll just tell you, I'm hostile to that. I am hostile to the idea that we will not have elections in 2026. I am aware that Donald Trump is going to do things to try to stay in power, to try to keep from there being oversight. But there is a difference between naivete and optimism. Naivete is thinking that everything will just work out. Optimism is understanding that people have agency and can make choices and that there is opportunity to win, right? And I think when you take that away from people, you leave them with a kind of nihilism that says, well, it's all over. But I really agree with this idea that we are in the middle of a fight and the No Kings protests is a important battle in that fight to demonstrate public opposition to Trump.
I just want to yes and that. Because again, sometimes the like word authoritarianism kind of flattens everything, right? And like, you know, for some people it's hard to like distinguish like what is the difference between Hungary and Russia, et cetera. And it's like you can get to a point of authoritarianism where there is kind of no point in having where like nihilism is the smart move, right? Because it's like it is over basically, right? At least for a period of time. And especially as a regular citizen, it's like, why, you know, engage, you know, why like find other areas of life? Like you see this in Russia and in other societies, right? And it's like, we're not there. And by acting as if it's a fait accompli, it makes people act like we're there already. And that's the part that I'm in particularly, you know, hostile to.
All right. So what you guys are talking about is essentially information warfare, which brings us to, I want to talk about Kristi Noem. The federal government is now spending more money on political ads than anyone else in the country. I think this is new. I don't think I remember the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Reagan administration. I don't believe I remember them just going up with propaganda, buying airtime to run propaganda ads on television. And yet here we are. Sarah?
There was See Something, Say Something.
It's a little different.
A little different.
It's more of like a PSA.
I feel like DHS did a few things, like with the red and the orange. They did, I mean, nothing like this, but there were a few little...
Weren't they like PSAs, winks, though?
I think.
I mean, that wasn't really like, you know... I don't know. You guys tell me.
This is absolutely different.
I agree it's different. I'm just saying it's not unprecedented. That's all.
Let me tell you. Okay.
Go ahead.
No. This to me is a real political innovation on their part that I have got to think is illegal if anybody cared about these laws anymore. I can't like walk you through all of the Hatch Act violations, but the idea that like they used to have to walk out of the White House. Like if you were on the White House's team, but you know, you were running for re-election, if you were doing something campaign related, you'd have to go and like leave the grounds. And so there was all this performative stuff they did to make sure that they weren't in violation of these rules. Now, listen, here's what's different. This is your taxpayer dollars, my taxpayer dollars, 51 million of our taxpayer dollars at a time when they are demanding, they're riffing people left and right. They're getting rid of all of these jobs. They won't help, you know, babies dying of AIDS in Africa anymore. We've just shut down USAID, but we've got $51 million for Kristi Noem to raise her brand awareness and ID in thanking Donald Trump for securing the border. Okay. This is political propaganda that your taxpayers are funding. It should not be legal. It should not be done. What Tim is talking about, like there were like Obama, for example, I was trying to think about what would an equivalent have been. So Obama, during the ACA rollout, there was some PSA and advertising like promoting Obamacare. Like, here's how you use it. Here's how you get on it. Okay. That is different. And Republicans complained about this at the time. There was anger about this at the time. Okay. Yeah. But even then they weren't saying, thank you, Barack Obama, for giving, you know, 50 million people healthcare. That's not what it was. It was like, here's the tools to use this program from the government, which the See Something, Say Something was in the wake of 9/11, where it was like, if you see something scary getting onto a plane or a train or whatever, point that out. Now you can say that those are cute. Like there have been ways for a long time of people to use different kinds of funds for political purposes that stay on the right side of the law.
Frank Tmail. Do you know about Frank Tmail? So this is a big congressional scam that's been going on forever, where like in Congress can send certain types of letters without postage. It's official business. So like you would send a mail to everybody, and like the other side would have to send a campaign mail. You would send mail that was like, we did a great job. Have you noticed the new park that just came in your neighborhood? Like Congressman so-and-so did that. And it's like, that was an official update, you know, anyway. So there, you know, there've been things such as this before.
Yeah, it's not, I would just say that the scale of it, the innovation, and here, and part of it is because Kristi Noem was doing this in South Dakota. Like I went back and looked, Kristi Noem put her face on the side of a NASCAR car, like a race car in the state as part of a,
her old
getting
face.
The word out. Yeah, but she also did weird dental things. She did. They were doing like
Fox News. She was running Fox News ads about South Dakota and how they're standing with Mr. Trump, like on primetime Fox, using South Dakota taxpayer dollars when she
was
governor.
That is straight boosting her own name ID, brand ID, brand awareness, using taxpayer dollars. And it would be like, just in the context of Doge, in the context of cuts, it is especially abhorrent. This has me really hot for whatever reason. Yeah. Especially because
I'm glad you're hot.
They dole out the contracts. They do snap contracts because acting like there's some kind of an emergency and give all this money to their buddies in Republican world to do these massive ad buys. Anyway, sorry, Tim.
No, it's good. And Corey Lewandowski, her maybe lover, maybe not. You know, who knows? I mean, they were texting under the table at the Benihana. Well, Corey Lewandowski was drunk and harassing another woman. But he's in charge of all that also. So he's like directing the money to like pals. And it's like the swamp. It's unimaginably swampy. The amount of money that's sloshing around. And this is a point that pisses me off. Like I was joking about how, yes, government has done stuff like this before. The scale of it is huge. The two other things that are very different for me. I mean, the ads are grotesque. I just like the way, the dehumanizing way they talk about immigrants and the way that they treat people in these ads. And just like, it's all just, it's very icky. Like just the actual contents of the ads are very icky in a way that this other stuff wasn't. But like the swampiness, like the amount of money that has been allocated to ICE. I know we talk about this, but it is hard for people to wrap their mind around the fact that ICE is going to have more money than the Israeli military. And so what do you do with all that money? Right. Like, so part of it is these stupid ads, right? Like part of it is agents that have no experience harassing people. You know, part of it is the new archipelago of camps that we're creating in the country. Part of it is right. Like, they're paying big money to people that are coming to work there. So you're getting people to go from other areas. You know, they're co-opting things that previously had been FBI responsibilities, other responsibilities of the government. And then the corruption. And who the hell knows what our friend Tom Homan, who he's given stuff to from, you know, Kava bags, right? Like all of that is like kind of just starting, right? But they know it's like being in any operation. I don't know if anybody has had this experience. Like this is a non-corrupt version of this. It's like I was once working for a PR firm that was like really on the way up. And so like all of a sudden they were flush with cash. And so, you know, the Christmas vacation that year was like in Vegas, right? Like everybody's going somewhere. It's like if you're working for a company that is like, I'm sure the Silicon Valley guys deal with this all the time, right? Like that's ICE, right? Like right now, like the organization in this country that is flush with cash, that is on the come up, that can throw money at people and bribe people is the fucking Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. And that is really scary and concerning.
Yeah. Is there any reason that this won't just become standard practice from here on out? Because I mean, it'll work, won't it?
What do you mean? This what? The ads, the propaganda ads?
This sort of thing. Right. Yeah. This sort of using government funds to run propaganda. Because this is, I mean, I was trying to think of like a way to explain the step change. These ads are to other normal, like federal public service ads, like the ACA, this is how do you get onto the healthcare exchanges and the See Something, Say Something, as Trump cabinet meetings are to previous cabinet meetings, right? Now, they're cabinet meetings, like, you know, you'd have the cabinet members sitting around the table and they would like, you know, and this is, we've done X, Y, and Z, and we are at stages 3, 4, and 7. Thank you. Thank you. And you, Secretary, and they go around and now it's like the death of Stalin. You know, it's everybody sitting around saying, oh, great Trump, you saved 470 million American lives last week, and no one has ever been as healthy as you. That's what this is. And if there isn't a price, and if it does help move public opinion, then why won't we get more of it?
We might, although I do think somebody should sue them over it. And I this should be against the law. You should not be allowed to use taxpayer funds to bolster people who are political candidates, and or not that Trump is going to be a candidate in 2020, because I already told you I'm hostile to that idea. But it is basically like a boon for his administration. Like, you are promoting the man, not even like a program. And so I hope they're sued for it.
Yeah, I think that the two ways in which this would not be permanent. Well, one, Trump's like the level of shamelessness of Trump. It is a superpower. It's like, you know, there's types of stuff that he does that if anybody else does, people would roll their eyes at it. I wish that weren't so, but it is. And so it's possible that other politicians, like, it doesn't work to the same effect it does for Trump, but maybe not. Though that would be one way that it would kind of peter out. The other, which is what I keep coming back to, is, like, to me, the only path to all of the JVL questions that end every segment, which is, Why will we not permanently go into horribleness? It's like, well, maybe we would. But one of the ideas that's a path out is that somebody's like somebody has an actual mandate to clean shit up, right? Like, and you see that sometimes in these sorts of places where corruption gets overboard. You see it in other countries, right? And the person that defeats it is kind of an outside reformer. That is what their mandate is, to not do shit like this, right? Like, that's possible that could happen, or it's possible that, like, an inverse happens, right, where somebody wins and says, okay, well, we're going to do exactly what they do. I think that both of those are potential outcomes for sure. Right? And obviously, if J.D. Vance or whatever, like, some other Republican wins, they're going to keep doing this. That almost goes without saying.
All right, time to hear from our first sponsor, Tim.
The show is sponsored by Mando, new sponsor. You know that feeling? You've been working hard all week. You know, you've been going to your ladies' weights class. And you might be smelling a little bit dank. And let's be honest, regular deodorant just doesn't cut it. Things are getting pretty ripe. But we've got a product that's a real game changer, Mando Deodorant Plus Sweat Control. This isn't just another cover-up. Mando is one stick, two jobs, powerful odor, and sweat control. You know, the gays, we like kind of powerful odor and sweat control sometimes. So, it's you want to use the Mando, but in the right setting. I don't know, Sarah, is that how things go in lesbian world?
I don't know, but I will say this. When I went to the gym the other day, and I was unlike Tim lifting, you know, little weights, I was doing big bench, you know, squats and stuff. And so I came back and JVL was in my office and I was like, I need to put on deodorant. And there was a Mando box in there. And I was like, ooh, this is a new sponsor. And I was like, this looks like it's for dudes, but you know what? I'm going to use it because I need it right now. And JVL was around me all day. Did I smell great or what?
Fantastic.
Clinical strength sweat control is what you call that. It's two times better at controlling sweat than the standard, even if you're doing lesbian weightlifting. And it controls the sweat and odor for 72 hours. The starter pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, and some other stuff, two free products of your choice. And as a special offer for our listeners, new customers get 20% off site-wide with our exclusive code. Use code THENEXTLEVEL at shopmando.com for 20% off site-wide plus free shipping. That's shopmando.com with the code THENEXTLEVEL. Please support our show and tell them we sent you.
So a big story in Politico yesterday about a bunch of young Republicans who had their Telegram chats, something like.
And let me guess, what were they talking about? How much they secretly don't like Trump and how they like free markets and free people.
A lot of it was about marginal tax rates.
Mm.
They really, it was very policy in depth, very wonky. Mm. Lots of talk about healthcare exchanges and interstate insurance rates and how they could do things. Infrastructure, also very, very concerned about infrastructure and government spending. No, it's mostly about saying very, very racist things about black people and
Indians and Asians, homosexuals as well.
So there's one moment in when somebody says something about, like, you know, having sex with women, and another member says sex is gay, and then another one says it wasn't sex, it was rape, and then the response to that is like, oh, well, that's awesome.
Based, I think, is the word they're using.
Based, right, based.
I think Mike Lee was in this chat. Mike Lee was not in this chat. Just joking.
It's the kind of thing where I would encourage people to go and read the piece, because this is one of those things where, you know, like the way long form magazine works is in the first two graphs, you try to give your readers a summary of what happens. And often, like in a newspaper story, the newspaper version of it, all the best stuff is in those first two paragraphs. This is like a 5,000 word, 6,000 word piece. And there's so much stuff that you can't forking believe that that summary at the top does not do it justice. Anyway, I just wanted us to bat this around a little bit. There is one part where one of them says, "I love Hitler." There's a lot of joking about gas chambers and Jews and turning showers into secret gas chambers. And there's an amazing line in there from a White House spokeswoman who says, "Oh, this is just like the media, you know, always try and compare people to Nazis." It's like the guys in it say they love Nazis. Like, I don't know what the problem is. I mean, I weep for the country, but I also have a serious question about, like, isn't this the future? These are young-ish people, by which I mean they're under the age of 40. These are not college kids. These were all grown professionals with jobs in politics, mostly in their 30s.
It was a state senator.
State senator, people who work for elected Republicans. But also, these are people whose entire adult frame of reference is Trumpism. And so for them, like when many people tend to talk about Trumpism as a fever that will break. And these people have never really known anything but the fever. They don't see it as like the temperature. This is just like their mother's milk. And I don't know how you get to places where everything kind of suddenly goes back to normal when the whole rising generation sees this as normal.
Well, not the whole rising generation. But I do think when this is the culture on the right. I'm trying to answer this without getting into like discourse on the discourse. But right now, in the wake of the Charlie Kirk murder, there's been a lot of discussion over which side is violent, who isn't, you know, and so then you have the Charlie Kirk murder. But then you've got Brian Kilmeade saying, let's just euthanize homeless people on Fox, for which he then apologizes. And then you go into Jay Jones, the guy running for attorney general in Virginia, who was texting one of his Republican colleagues insanely, talking about how that, you know, his someone in the one of the Republicans should be shot, as should his children. Now you've got these text messages from the entire, young Republican establishment. These are not, you know, people outside the establishment. This is firmly, these are like young, like the YRs, which, Tim, were you in YRs? Did you ever butt up against them?
I attended a single YR meeting, during which there was some discussion of a new politics board game that people were creating. And I found out that at age 17, I was thinking that like I was going to meet other young 17-year-olds. And to JBL's point about how these people are young, it was like actually like really sad 30-year-olds in frumpy suits and who kind of smelled bad. And after that meeting, I was like, you know, I don't know if this group is for me. So I think that was my own. And then occasionally I'd have candidates who'd have to speak to them or whatever. So I'd go, whatever. But that was the only time I came on my own volition.
Yeah. So I also was very not interested in these people, but I still bumped up against them. And the thing to understand about them is that they're the strivers. They want to be in charge of the party. Like they sort of, it's sort of like if the F1 is the real race, the F2 is like the junior league, right? This is AAA ball where they're all cutting their teeth on how they, you know, get ahead.
Networking, a lot of networking.
Yeah, it's all about networking, but it's also there's power struggles, right? These leaked emails are a product of a power struggle within the YRs and who was up and who was down. But this is their culture. And I think that the idea that randos on Twitter criticizing Charlie Kirk or saying that they're not going to, that he's bad, or celebrating his death. That was awful. We hated it. We condemned it. That is different from Jay Jones, who's running for AG, who's an elected official who I think should have to drop out. I think Abigail Spanberger should tell him, if you win, we're not seating you. You got to resign. I thought what he did was abhorrent. But in both those cases, the right jumped to say the left is the party of violence. The left is the party of extreme rhetoric. But right now, we see exactly what the culture of the upcoming young people are, which, by the way, mirrors the culture of the president and vice president of the United States. Okay, this idea that you try to take the randos in the Charlie Kirk situation or the AG in Virginia and compare it to the president, the vice president, how they talk, and the entire now culture of the right that is coming up, those are somewhat different things. That being said, this is clearly a problem in the way Americans talk about things. Like, too many people, and this is a product, I think, of social media, where we are too detached from the humanity of others. Like, when I saw that shower gas chamber joke, I don't know about you, but I remember sitting in a movie theater and watching Schindler's List and watching, there was a moment where they shepherded people into showers. But of course, that was the big thing. They told people they were going to get a shower and then they gassed them to death. And there's this moment where the water hits them and it's actually water that is this massive moment of relief in the movie. And I'm like, are these kids just too young to have that sit with them in any kind of way, where everything's about being subversive and nihilistic and diminishing people's humanity? I understand it's a backlash to wokeism, but man, it is, it's a tough take on humanity.
A lot there. I'm doing my best.
I know. I went on a rant.
I had like five different, I had responses to five different parts of what you said. So I'm going to try to remember them and I'll try to be brief. You did discourse on the discourse. I wasn't going to do this, but you did discourse on the discourse. So now I have to do discourse on the discourse on the discourse. Cause I'll get to these little Nazis in a second, but like, it wasn't really randos on Twitter actually only that was saying really nasty things about Charlie Kirk. Like, there was a lot of people on the left that were saying nasty things about Charlie Kirk, after he died. And when those of us that spoke out about that, people got really mad at us and we're like, don't lecture them. And I only bring this up just to say, like, this did spiral out of control on the right. Like, we did see this coming for a long time. And a culture was created on the right where people not only accepted it, but encouraged people that were being their nastiest and worst selves, up to and including the now president of the United States. And it is incumbent on people to self-police their own side to prevent this from happening, or it can spiral out of control. There's nothing like inherently beautiful about believing in big government versus small government that makes you less susceptible to being attracted to tribal violent thinking. And so I think that some people on the left think that there is, and you've seen very violent political movements, as JVL wrote, I think very well earlier this week, coming from basically every ideology imaginable. So that, like, it is incumbent among people to resist it with an outside. I know you agree with me on this, Sarah. I do agree with you on it.
I only meant, I'm trying to distinguish between elected Democratic officials, who were sort of uniformly behaved appropriately.
Which I appreciated. And the elected, and to the funny part, well, you get to the elected Democratic officials, the Jay Jones thing is funny because Andrew Agger pointed this out on Twitter, which I thought was funny. J.D. Vance posted, our vice president, about the young Nazis, to your point about bad, about vice signaling and bad incentives within an organization and coalition. The vice president of the United States posted saying, meh, bunch of college kids, boys will be boys. And he said the real problem is Jay Jones, who's an actual elected official, saying what he said. And Egger points out, he's like, Jay Jones was in the state legislature when he sent those texts. There's a state senator on these texts. It's like the same. It's the same. I like that. Like,
Jay Jones is the same age as them.
Yeah.
Like, and he's 36. They're like 32.
It's a parallel thing. Yeah. So it's bad. It's bad. And so, like, that, it's important to say, to your point also, Sarah, about the YRs and who these people are. It's not like random grassroots people. It's the head of the New York YRs. The person who allegedly leaked this, Gavin Wax, I got to know pretty well because I was kind of down the path on doing kind of a long form thing on Young MAGA that just never came to fruition. And so I was spending a lot of time with the Young MAGAs for a little while. And like Gavin Wax, who was like in the power struggle with the guy that's doing the monkey jokes and all the horrible, nasty jokes, is like now a very senior person at the State Department. Right. And it's like, had he lost the power struggle to the other guy, that guy could, you know what I mean? Like, these are mm-hmm. people that are going to, that are now and on the way to becoming very prominent. And to me, that is like the deeply alarming part about all this. Back to your original question, JVL, about where this is headed. Like, again, it wasn't as if there weren't racist jokes and young Republican groups in 1996 or 1976. Like, there were, obviously. Like, there's an element of this always. But, like, the culture of, like, encouraging it and almost like if you don't participate, that means you're the bad one. It's a sign of weakness, right? The culture of drawing people into this based on that. Right, like that they're like that the thing that they're leading with on the front of the pamphlet is like, we hate Mexicans and we're gonna make nasty, cruel, racist jokes, and like, we, you know, believe in America first and white Christian nationalism or whatever. Like, that being the first page of the pamphlet versus, you know, like the first page of the pamphlet being free markets and free people. And like, we also have some people here that write in the letters to the editor that's write that stuff. Like, that's not good either. Like, you know what I mean? But like, sure. It's difference. It is a huge difference. And when you look at poll numbers, the 18 to 34 MAGAs have much more radical views on cultural and race issues than the 60 to 75 MAGAs. And that is just reality and where we're going.
Am I right in concluding that in our best case scenario, Trumpism, not Donald Trump, but Trumpism remains the dominant strain of Republican politics for at least the next 7 years?
Oh, seven? Yeah. Yes.
I'm doing the most conservative estimate ever. So I guess what I'm trying to say is we are going to wind up with an entire generation for whom this stuff is what politics is.
Yes.
That's great. Sarah, want to talk to us about Quince?
This show is sponsored by Quince. Cooler days call for layers that last, and Quince is my go-to for quality essentials that feel cozy, look refined, and won't blow your budget. Think $50 Mongolian cashmere, premium denim that fits like a dream, and luxe outerwear you'll wear year after year. These are the pieces that turn into your fall uniform, and I love a fall uniform. You may be wondering, what kind of uniform? Are you on a sports team, Sarah? Yes, the fall is the Super Bowl for lesbians. I'm getting one of their wool coats. They look designer level, but cost a fraction of the price, and the quality, honestly, just as good, if not better. Because Quince partners with top-tier ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, they deliver luxury quality pieces at half the price of similar brands. It's the kind of wardrobe upgrade that feels smart, stylish, and effortless. And if you know my style, you know I like effortless. Find your fall staples at Quince. Go to quince.com/thenextlevel for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too, which is awesome. We love Canada. That's quince.com/thenextlevel to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/thenextlevel. Thanks, Quince.
So this week, up in the great state of Maine, Governor Janet Mills said that she's going to run for Senate. Somebody else who's in the challenging Susan Collins, somebody else who had already declared, then backed out. Mills is 77 right now. Says she would only serve one term. She'd be the oldest freshman senator in history. Our colleague Lauren Egan has a great piece coming out later this week. She went up to Maine and sat down with Graham Plattner, who is the oysterman. Is that a thing? Are you an oysterman? Who is sure. Already in the race and is kind of like Bernie in the sheets, Fetterman in the streets. Can I say that?
Yeah, because it's actually as well put, because I'm not sure people know. Well, we'll get to it. Keep going.
I have so many questions about Democrats and whether like this is the sensible thing to do or the not sensible thing to do. And Sarah, I sense that you have a great many thoughts on this.
I do, but I'll just give you the top lines so that I don't go on as long as I did last time. Which is
you can go on as long as you want. I'm just I was just saying that I kept being like, "Ooh, I need to say another thing on that," but I'm not going to interrupt. And so then, you said another thing. I was like, "Ooh, I have something to say on that." And so you
know, it's just
a lot of different points.
We all have lots of thoughts. That's all. I just want to make sure you get in here too. We can have a healthy back and forth.
Great.
But I just want to give you quickly. Look, the bull case for Janet Mills is that there are a lot of, you know, sort of Collins Mills voters out there. Mills has been on the ballot. She's governor. She wins by large margins. There's a reason that they think that she's going to be a good candidate. And I would say the bear case on Plattner is that he's super untested. You know, I'm not objecting to his progressivism, or he's an untested candidate kind of out of nowhere. And he could have all kinds of crazy things in his past. He, you know, and so I think my main take is pun intended. Good. My main take is Democratic primary good here. Let's kick the tires on Plattner. I do think, I do want to burn down though, and I use that metaphorically, the DNC and the Democratic Senatorial Committee that has decided to do like joint ads with her. Okay, now Tim wants to get in. I just want to make my take clear, which is I'm pro the new candidates, barring anything insane jumping out in the bio that we don't know about. And I'm down with the gerontocracy. And I think that the DNC needs to freshen itself up in terms of what it's allowing through the races. Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you. I'm with you on all of that. And it's funny, like people get very attached and passionate. I got to an argument with somebody recently about the Gloria Plattner thing, where they're like, this is your crypto Republican showing. And I'm like, if Graham Plattner is the right path, and if he's a good, strong outsider populist candidate, and I disagree with him on some economic issues, I'm fine. Like, great. Like, whatever. Like, this is what we need. It's laboratories of democracy. We need to figure out how to beat the Republicans. I'm for all that. My point was just like, a lot of people seem to have like gotten attached to him based on like three video clips.
Yeah.
And lots of people can do good three good video clips, you know, and who don't turn out to be that great otherwise. And, you know, JVL has the tattoo of John Fetterman that he has to cover up now, which is why he's always wearing long sleeve shirts.
It'll be with me for forever.
So like all I was saying to this person who's very excited about Graham Plattner is like, let's just see. Let's just like chill out. It's a long campaign. It's chill out. Like maybe he's going to be awesome and the next coming. And maybe it turns out he's got skeletons in his closet or he's Fetterman or whatever. I don't know. Like, let's just see. So in that sense, it's fine. The Jan Mills get in the ways. That's since I was a little kind of disappointed. There's another guy, Dan Cleban, who's an outsider, more of kind of a normie mainstream outsider that was running, but he dropped out and is endorsing Mills. I don't know enough about the race to know whether that was smart or not, but just as an outsider, it's kind of like would have been nice to have a few options. And so we'll kind of see how that all shakes out. Sarah's point, though, the thing where I'm like the most on the side of the Plattner partisans. And I think that this is also kind of on the side of people that just want to have good candidates, even more mainstream candidates. It's like what the DSC is doing in this race in Michigan is insane and is probably going to backfire. And I'm going to go deeper on this with Peter Hamby, my buddy, on Friday, because we both lived on both sides, him as a journalist, me as an operative, on like in the Republican Party as the Tea Party rose. Right. And there are some weaknesses to that parallel between the Plattner and the Tea Party. But just like from a strategic standpoint, all those Tea Party candidates like were succeeding early. Your friend Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle, like they're winning all of these primaries, right? And then like the establishment responded and they were like, we're going to put our thumb on the scale for people and we're going to get in there. And that ended up hurting those candidates. Like it ended up backfiring because people don't want the establishment coming in and telling them who to vote for. Like, you know, and then eventually they kind of came up with a strategy that's quasi worked until Trump came around, where it was like they were co-opting the smart crazies and then like using cutouts to defeat the crazies was basically the system. It's like I'm for strategically, if you're the Democrats, trying to make sure you're backing the best candidates, but like to just at the beginning of the race in Michigan, like picking Haley Stevens, like and Maine picking Janet Mills, like when both of them have their own issues, including one of them being the oldest possible first-term senator ever, and Stevens is not exactly the most dynamic candidate, it's like, what are you doing? To me, I just think that it is going to that it is both bad optics and it might end up harming their stated goals of getting the strongest person in. So I don't, maybe somebody from the DSCC will call me and explain to me what their strategy is, and maybe there's something I'm missing, but it seems pretty dumb to me, and it seems like they should learn a little bit more from what McConnell World did in the 2010s.
I just want to like weigh in on the Michigan. I'm angry. I'm even angrier about the Michigan one, because it's this one, at least in the case of Plattner versus Janet Mills, there's a question of, I don't know, does this guy turn out to be like a psycho? Like, yeah, he looks like he'd be good at like slugging 12 beers, and he could probably like, you know, he could fix your carburetor. Like, that's how he looks.
Which is great.
Maine does love its moderates, right? It's got an independent and then an apostate Republican as its two senators. And so can a progressive firebrand like him win? I don't know. It's good to test them out. That's not the case in Michigan. In Michigan, they're just backing Haley Stevens just because, like, Mallory McMorrow is out fundraising, like, she's an excellent candidate. There's nothing about her that says, I'm a big threat to the establishment, other than she looks like a good candidate. I don't know. And so, like, I don't know what these guys in the Democratic Party are doing, and I really don't understand. So here's the other thing. Kamala Harris just lost to Donald Trump, in part by being just kind of, like, a safe Democrat at a moment when people are ready for change. Like, what is what is one term of Janet Mills? I don't know why they think that's going to win in an environment that is right. Remember, Susan Collins pulled it out back in 2020 in a much in what I think was a more difficult environment for her. And like, she won handily. So like, a one term of Janet Mills doesn't make a ton of sense to me. Also, then Democrats still find themselves with only a one term senator, right? They're giving up incumbency. Like, there's a bunch of the strategy around this that doesn't make any sense. But let them run it out. Let him cut his teeth in a real race against somebody meaningful, and let whoever wins fine. The big guy should stay out of it. The DS, what is it? The
Christine Democrat Gillibrand, Senator DSCC. Yeah, like, well, I don't know.
Schumer, Gillibrand. They have the political. Their political instincts are a nightmare.
All right, I want to talk about Plattner in a minute, but first, a word from Green Chef, our sponsor. Fall is my favorite season. The crisp air, cozy sweaters, the biggest baseball games of the year on TV, which are keeping me up too late every night. It's the perfect time to reset and bring healthy habits back into focus. And with Green Chef, the number one meal kit for clean eating, you can do just that. Green Chef makes it easy to spend less time in the kitchen and more time enjoying fall. And with their new Heat and Eat meals, enjoy a delicious, wholesome meal in just 3 minutes. It's the best part. 3 minutes. Perfect for supporting your wellness journey. Green Chef recipes feature fresh, organic, seasonal produce and 100% responsibly sourced proteins to help you feel your best. Green Chef's real clean ingredients help you build lasting healthy habits without the hassle. Enjoy salads ready in just 5 minutes, protein-filled breakfasts, or nutrient-rich smoothies to fuel your day. Green Chef is ready to nurture your nutritional needs. With 80-plus dietitian-approved weekly meal options, Green Chef makes it easy to find meals that fit your lifestyle. Pick from Mediterranean, gluten-free, plant-based, and protein-heavy, even gut and brain health, and calorie smart choices too. The recipes change every week, and with week-to-week flexibility, you can adjust your plan to match your mood and your schedule. I've been doing a lot of the Heat and Eat Green Chef meals, and they're amazing because the normal Green Chef meals are really low prep time. The Heat and Eat are zero prep time, which for me is, I mean, it's the greatest thing ever. Make this fall your healthiest yet with Green Chef. Head to greenchef.com/50nextlevel and use code 50nextlevel to get 50% off your first month, then 20% off for 2 months with free shipping. That's code 50nextlevel at greenchef.com/50nextlevel. I would like to talk to you guys a little bit about Plattner, because I have sneak previewed Lauren Egan's interview with him.
Oh, really? Do you like it? Do you like what you read?
I did. It's a great interview. Lauren Egan, good reporter. like that Lauren Egan. She's going places. People should subscribe to her newsletter, The Opposition, over at thebulwark.com/ding ding ding. Plattner's focus, his singular focus, is universal healthcare. And he frames it all as a rural guy. Like, I live in a county, I live in a town with 1,000 people in a county out on the water. All of my friends are 3-time Trump voters, and our, you know, access to healthcare in our rural community is getting devastated, and places are shutting down, and people's premiums keep going up for the ones who can even get health insurance. And we need to do something about this to affect the cost of living and help people. And we need to fund it by taxing the billionaire tech oligarchs. Is that going to work? Which is separate from, do you like it?
You keep talking. What do you mean? I don't understand the inflection of your question. What do you mean? Is that going to work? Like, does the policy work? Or like,
do the politics of it work? And this is where I just don't know. And I mean, I think the politics of this could depend in large part on the AI bubble. Most observers seem to believe that we are in an enormous economic bubble right now, created by the AI boom, which has just brought insane amounts of spending without a whole lot of income on AI. Many people, including people in AI, kind of expect it to burst. People are already, Tim, you talked about this with Casey Newton. People already hate the AIs, right? I mean, there was, in the way that tech has always loved its tech founders, and it really liked Steve Jobs, and it liked Sergey and Larry, and people don't like AI.
Yeah, like on its launch, MySpace, Facebook, like going all the way back, the iPhone, MySpace, the iPod, Facebook, like on their launch, they all had like 90% approval ratings. So it was like 10% of Luddite opposition at all times. And it's like, it's much more a mixed bag with AI starting from a much lower baseline of support.
So if the AI bubble bursts and it pulls the broader economy into recession with it, I think that talking about the AI tech oligarchs is going to be a very politically appealing message. And if the universal healthcare is paired with, and we're doing this as a way to punish the people we hate, that's a very different proposition politically from the utopian, hey, we ought to make, you know, healthcare is a human right.
Yeah, we're gonna get, right? Because
that feels like hippie talk.
People don't think are working hard enough. Yeah.
Whereas we're gonna fuck these AI nerds who made hundreds of billions of dollars off of us, and I guess with that money we'll do better healthcare. I think that can appeal to a wider swath, but who knows? I don't know. I think it's interesting.
I mean, look, there's a clear formula. In terms of what voters want, I will lay this all out at a later date for everybody. But like, it is, to me, politics right now is kind of simple, and it is not my preferred, but it is social moderation to conservatism and economic populism. And the number one thing that the massive voters across the political spectrum care about right now is affordability, not income inequality, affordability. It is not just, hey, these guys make a lot and we don't make enough, right? It's not, it's actually a different frame. It's like everything's too expensive. And what I like about Plattner's onto something here. He's decided what voters mean is they mean healthcare's too expensive. They mean groceries are too expensive. Gas is too expensive. Like everything is too expensive. And if you talk about affordability broadly, including with healthcare, and rather than talking about income inequality, you say, but these tech billionaires don't care about us being able to afford things, right? They're trying to distract us with their garbage, hijack our brains while everything just gets more expensive around us. Because I agree, creating a certain, like, I think these guys,
including energy very directly, actually, there's a direct energy tie between electricity prices. Yeah.
And so I think that you don't want it to get narrow. I think that Democrats needed to widen this aperture around affordability broadly. And I think that's a good message for them. I think that's a politically salient one for them.
My short answer, JBL, is I don't know. I think it could work. I don't know, though. I think it's more likely to be able to work in Maine for some reasons that are distinct to Maine. And it's important to remember that Maine is like a Maine's a pretty weird state. I mean, it's a state super that Kamala weird. Harris won, and that is also very white, and that is also very blue collar. Like, there just like isn't. So I do worry a little bit about like people taking if like I think Plattner totally could win. I think maybe he's totally the right candidate for Maine. Maybe. I don't want then everybody to be like, oh, we need to do exactly this campaign everywhere, because like I think Plattner, if you listen to him, is like pretty socially liberal and like pretty astute in like a lot of the social justice language that I think is not going to fly as much in down in my neck of the woods, you know, or even and, you know, Ohio, some of these other places the Democrats seem to win. But that said, I agree with basically everything Sarah said. I do think the main thing is a little unique.
It's the future socialist. I mean,
aren't we in socialism?
We basically are.
I am like done. I can we just make a new rule that when the clock hits 1 hour, we no longer ask questions like,
okay,
how is society going to turn out in the next 100 years? Like, okay. You know, it's like,
you're
killing me, Smalls. Is the future socialist? I don't fucking know. I don't know. We're in a socialist back and forth right now. We have socialist Republicans running in charge. We have
Republicans who are buying governmental stakes and shares in American companies. We have the most exciting politician on the Democratic side is AOC. Mamdani's doing very well in New York. It just seems like the appetite in America for somebody who is just a very normal...
I guess, okay, if we're going to do this, though, now, no. Like, look, the most popular politicians in the country are governors or free market, are governors. Like, what state, where are the most dynamic parts of the country right now? Places that are being run by pretty pro-capitalist governors of both parties, Colorado, Utah, Georgia. So, no, I guess would be my answer.
Okay.
So, here, I do a great focus group pod this week with this guy, Harry Siegel, who is like this nonprofit journalist in New York. He's like one of my favorite people to talk to about New York politics. And he will tell you something that I think people really need to understand as they think about Mamdani, which is that Mamdani can give people lessons around, hey, communications. But in terms of taking New York, the New York City, as a model for what kind of candidates you run broadly, nobody should do that. It is an incredibly weird place. It is incredibly specific. And the idea that socialism is the future, no, but here is what I do think will happen. It's a little bit like, you know, I've heard David Frum say, and I say this on the pod, he says something, he has a line about if sort of the liberals, and by liberals, he means, you know, liberal Democrats, not just political Democrats, everybody in a liberal democracy, if they don't control borders, then the authoritarians will. And I think that is a true thing that has happened. Like, don't send me emails about Joe Biden's last minute legislation that was going, if I get one more Pearson being, Sarah always forgets that Joe Biden put up this legislation, not before there was an enormous amount of damage done around the border. Okay. So just spare me that piece. But it's similar to if Democrats and centrists or basically just everybody in liberal democracy doesn't focus on affordability, then the socialists will win. Like if people who are part of the DSA are the only ones talking about voters feeling squeezed on prices in a tremendous way, then they will start to attract Democratic voters. And so my advice to Democrats is to focus on affordability, because this is what voters broadly care about.
That is fantastic. That's a great last word. It's been a good show.
That's the last word?
Show. I think it was the perfect thing to end on, Tim. But if you have something else,
that's great. I did want to talk about Pritzker. You complimented the Pritzker interview, so that's fine. People should just go check it out. I just want to leave it as well. While we're nitpicking the Democrats, I do want to leave the show. My last word for the show is: I don't think that the DCCC should be getting their hands involved in primaries right now, at least in the way that they're doing it. I think that's a mistake. I do think national Democrats should be pressuring the governors of these other blue states to do what Gavin Newsom's doing. And I don't understand why that's not happening. And I thought Governor Pritzker was really strong in our interview on his messaging. I think the Democrats could learn a lot from him about how to talk about the authoritarian threat. But I was unsatisfied with the discussion around redistricting in Illinois. And I think that this is a very important issue. And I just, wanted to take an opportunity to have a final word on that.
Maybe Sarah and I will talk about that on the Secret Pod on Friday.
I love that. You guys should do that.
Good show. Long show. Everybody, we'll be back next week. We'll bring you a little tidbit taste of the Secret Pod on Friday. Good luck, America.
Bye.